Hi, this is Andrew, and this is Keynote, the daily now.tv chat show with some of the world's leading thinkers and writers. Hello, everyone, from a powerless San Francisco, thank goodness, four laptops and self-powered laptops. It's June 1st, 2023. Of course, power cuts are one thing, living through wars are quite another, especially the Second World War. What does the Second World War mean to novelists? I think there's a degree of disagreement. We had one novelist on the show last September, Kristen Beck, who believed that World War II remains seductive for novelists because it's a simple war between good and evil, and it allowed them to juxtapose good and evil. I'm not sure that my guest today, and Kristen Beck wrote a wonderful book, The Winter Orphans, around that. It's, of course, true and legitimate in some contexts. But I'm not sure that my guest today, Andrew Krivak, who has a new book out, third in a trilogy, Like the Appearance of Horses. I'm not sure if it's a trilogy, certainly a book with characters from two previous books. In a sense, it's a book about the Second World War, and in a sense, it's a book about all wars. But it's certainly not a book which, as Kristen Beck suggests, makes war into writing about good and evil, or at least that's my sense. Andrew is joining us from his home in Somerville, Massachusetts. Andrew, is that fair? I don't want to put words into your mouth, and I'm sure you won't let me. You're too sophisticated a writer for that. Are you attracted to wars in particular? I mean, this is the third in, as I said, a series. The first book was The Sojourn about World War One. Second, The Signal Flame about Vietnam. Always about war, but always about the moral complexity of war. Is that fair?
Yeah. Yes, Andrew. Thanks. And first of all, thanks for having me on. This is really quite a treat. Moral complexity, I think, is spot on. And let me say, just personally, my two grandfathers, my father's father, fought in World War One for the Americans, 1917 to 1918. He's with the 9th Field Artillery in France. My mother's father fought with the Austrians in the Landwehr as a Slovak conscript. And so I heard about these stories from my grandmothers. My grandfathers had passed away when I was a boy. And I know that my father was in World War II. He was in the South Pacific, and all of his brothers, his oldest brother was a CB in the South Pacific. His middle brother was a radio operator in Burma. And my father was in the Solomon Islands on the way to the invasion of Japan. So that was World War One. That was World War II for me. And then my brothers were getting ready to go to Vietnam. There's a big stretch, about 13 years, I think, between the two side, the brothers and the family. I just thought, you know, as a young boy, you become a young man and you fight your war in America and you get on with it if you came back. But World War II specifically, I think this notion of moral complexity really goes back to The Sojourn and my understanding of World War One. And so it was quite natural, since Bechette Conner and Joseph Vinich are really, Joseph Vinich certainly comes of age in World War One, and Bechette Conner is born in the aftermath of World War One. I wanted World War II to mirror that as well. So the passages in Like the Appearance of Horses, where Bechette Conner is fighting in the Hurtgen Forest and then lost in the Ardennes, I tried to do that with respect to, I would say, moral complexity, moral ambiguity. What is right and what's not right? I don't know that in the face of that war, if I were my grandfather's, my father's, or anyone who was in Vietnam, I don't know that I could answer that. So,
another book that comes to mind, I'm not sure if you're familiar with Alexander Heman's new book, The World and All that it holds. It's a World War One book, but it's also a book about storytelling. Your book is about storytelling, the nature of stories, their eternal return, a narrative that never ends. Talk to me a little bit about that and what you learned from your grandmother about storytelling.
Right. It all begins with storytelling for me. And from my grandmother, first of all, you know, she lived up the street
from us. This is your Slovakian grandmother.
No, actually, this is my mother's grandmother, Elizabeth Magda. So she was born in Colorado. Her father, Andrew, after whom I'm named, his wife and their young baby boy, my great uncle Joe, were on a trestle in over the Arkansas River. That's the opening of the sojourn. It's a true story. She was walking along the trestle with a 5-year-old nephew and with her son in her arms. The nephew got his foot caught in the rails as the train was coming by, and she couldn't do anything to get him out. So she threw her son over the trellis into the water, over the trestle into the water. And some boys who were swimming, Roy Palmer was the boy who was swimming that day with his buddies. They swam out and rescued the baby. And my great grandfather brought his three daughters and his young baby son back to Austria, what was Austria-Hungary at the time. So she lived as a widow up the street from us in Pennsylvania, back dead end, dirt road. And we just went up there with my mom, and, you know, my mother would take care of her, take her to pay the light bill in town. And we just heard stories all the time about the old country. She didn't necessarily like it very much. You know, she grew up with the proverbial wicked stepmother and just had a rough time of it. So when she wanted to go to America, she was 16. She went to her father and she said, you know, essentially, "Dad, I want to go to America." This was after the war. And he said, "I knew you'd ask me that." He had all her papers. She was an American citizen because she was born in America. So stories where it all started. And then as I got older, I was able to start asking my dad about the stories about World War II. And he was reticent. But, you know, he talked a lot about the South Pacific. He was a chemist who was trained in a mortar division. He missed going to Guadalcanal by a company and didn't go well for the company that did go. So I think he didn't talk of it much because he had this, you know, I don't know what to call it now, perhaps this humbled respect of fate. And he had what he had because one day he...
As you write about all these different wars, American wars, not just American wars, in like the appearance of horses, the First World War, the Second World War, Vietnam. Are you trying as a novelist to distinguish them or to treat war as the same as this tragically morally ambiguous thing that causes so much suffering?
Wow, that's a really good question. I'm never one for the either or. I always think in terms of the both and. However, I wouldn't want to say, I don't really say history repeats itself on a grand scale. So can I say there's both reflections and similarities and differentiations? And I think that that's part of the complexity.
Andrew, you can say whatever you like. You're the authority. When it comes to war, again, we know from our headlines today, we had a very distinguished British historian, Richard Overy, written one of the great books on the Second World War. And I asked him when he came on the show last year whether the Second World War had ended yet. And he doesn't, I think it has. And seems from news reports in Ukraine that in some ways what's happening there now is the afterlife of the Second World War. When you look at your headlines today, you're not a political analyst, of course, but are you writing this book and your series of books about war as, in a sense, a warning about fetishizing war and glory and reminding people that the stories of wars never really end? And, you know, we can say, well, it all began in the First World War, and then before the First World War, you could go back to Napoleon, and I'm sure before Napoleon, there were many other wars too.
Well, first, I think I just set out as a kind of homage to my grandmother, really, my parents, you know, just to, stories are what they gave me. And so stories was what I wanted to make as a craftsperson in the world. But I do ultimately, you know, as I do write more and think more deeply about these things, I you know, very much a, I mean, what's happening in Ukraine, I just, every day I have to hold back the tears, you know, because these are my people. My father was an ethnic Ruthenian, and Ruthenia, the ethnic Rus were that place that disappeared essentially after World War I between what is now the border of Ukraine and Slovakia. They're entirely different, a similar Slavic culture, their own language, even their own school of iconography. So that just really saddens me. But I think my father, my grandparents, and if my grandfathers were alive as well, they would say, you know, just be careful. I think they told those stories as a way of passing along that that caution, if you will. Yes, I agree with you on that, Andrew.
World War One and Two, of course, are global wars in every sense. Vietnam is a uniquely American war. Does that make it more or less challenging for you as a fiction writer?
Very much so, yeah. When I started The Sojourn, I imagined this much bigger novel about a generation of families at war. And so in many ways, this is a trilogy that each one of the books is standalone, but I really did imagine a much bigger book. And as I started to pare it down, The Sojourn became that, the speaking of Joseph Vinich in many ways, I imagined Marlowe on the stern there of the yawl, Nellie from Heart of Darkness, telling the guys on the boat the story. I had Bo Connor in there, and then I had Sam Connor, and I realized it was just Bo, and I was wondering why was Bo there and alone, and I imagined Sam being away in Vietnam. And then it just didn't matter who was listening. We all listened to the story in that first person point of view. And so The Sojourn became a sort of performative act of Joseph Vinich telling about World War One, his own coming of age, as a way of saying, this is the way wars shape us and has shaped me. Vietnam emerged in that way. I know it from thinking about my brothers. My brother didn't go, by the way. The draft stopped months before he was ready to. He entered the Coast Guard. So, but yes, I'm aware of that. I'll tell you this, Andrew, though. As I sit in front of my keyboard and think about, okay, so I've not been in combat. What do I do? I wrote The Sojourn entirely at the distance of World War One. Thinking about my grandmother, doing a great deal of research at the War Museum in London, I wanted to channel my grandfather. It's fiction, but there was a voice I needed to grab onto, and it was his. My first reading, a gentleman in the first row stood up and he said, "I was an Army Ranger Scout in Vietnam, and I wanted to know how you got it right." And I thought, wow, I was expecting the opposite. And I don't know if you know from my biography, but I was 8 years studying with the Jesuits to be ordained a priest, but left in theology studies and, left happily and without, just because it wasn't the life for me. But I told him, I said, listen, I've not been in war, but I know what it is to be a man in formation. And so that is what I try to hold on to as a writer of these wars. And then make sure I do my research.
Andrew, when I think of the little man in war, I think of the Czech hero, Švech. Is there an element of that in your book?
I don't know. I mean, I've certainly read Švech. I think...
The little man challenging, making fun of authority persistently, perpetually, standing up to the state.
Yes, yeah, certainly Captain Prosh at Fort Sherrill in The Sojourn is sort of Švech like. He's a little bit, wants to be a little bit bigger than he actually is. There really was Captain Prosh really was the commander of Fort Sherrill. You can go see the plaques up there. Apparently he was a really great guy. But yes, I think I was trying to get that sense of being a little bit too big for people being too big for who they are, what they want to do. But, I like that Švech is in the background. I will say that I wasn't actively thinking about the good soldier in my writing. So
people, of course, associate Švech with Czechoslovakia, but of course he was Czech, and the Slovaks and the Czechs have since split. Mm-hmm. You are very much in the tradition of Slovakian writing and culture, which you put into your books. Are there particular Slovakian writers who have influenced you, who you consider you're writing in some sort of tradition?
Yeah, not really. I think I'm entirely American. I lived in Bratislava for a time as a Jesuit. I studied Slovak. I listened to Slovak my entire life. And it turns out it was an Eastern dialect called Šadiš that my grandmother spoke. And both my parents spoke to each other. So it was their secret language. I read some of the poetry of Milan Rufus, who's a contemporary Slovak poet. But no, I'm respectful of the fact that I don't, the language is in my ear, but the literature is not part of my capacity to, you know, to think about. So there's not much of it, actually. I mean, there's not a lot of slope.
And that Central European world is so complicated and interesting. We did a show in March of this year with Patty McCracken. I'm not sure if you're familiar with her new book,
not.
Angel Makers. It was about a mass killing in Hungary after the First World War. Women who turned on the men and poisoned them. I think almost 80 men were poisoned in a village near Budapest. In gender terms, this was a much more traditional world. You're very influenced by your grandmother and her storytelling. Is there an element of that in the book, if not a feminism, of certainly addressing the issue of women and women's rights?
Absolutely. Yeah, I'm glad you mentioned that. Like the Prince of Horses begins with a young Hannah Connor, Joseph Vinich's daughter, Hannah Vinich at the time, and then finishes with Hannah Connor as a much older woman. And my grandmother, my mother worked as well, but when we were at that age where we needed a parent, she stepped out of, she was a medical technologist, a histologist in a hospital lab. She stepped out of work and raised us until we got into high school. And then my father said to us, all right, it's time. You guys have to cook and clean, and your mother's going back to work. If you want to go to college, this is what she's got to do. And so, you know, we all stepped in and did what we had to do. So I think that's always been a part of just the way I think about the world and the women in my family, especially in the Eastern European tradition, which was strong. They were strong women. Can I tell you about the woman in Like the Appearance of Horses? It's Frances Posel. It's a true story that my mother and father didn't actually know about this. I didn't know about it either. I'd been back to the village where my grandmother grew up several times. And I took my mother and father in there probably a decade before they passed away. My mother's great aunt, so her father's sister, was a spinster her whole life, seamstress in Wilkes-Barre, lived in a small flat that always smelled of mothballs and rye whiskey, although, you know, she never drank, actually. But she would go away to Czechoslovakia behind the Iron Curtain, and my mother would always ask my grandmother, you know, why don't you want to go with her? And my grandmother would say, I don't want anything to do with that place. And Aunt Sue would go, and she'd come back, and she'd go for long stretches of time, and she'd come back. And when we visited Vitsaj, this village, in the back of the church, St. Joseph the Worker, there's a plaque by the baptismal font that's essentially says, in memory of Susan Stafila, whose tireless efforts to maintain the church under the Iron Curtain will not be forgotten. She was bringing money to the priest the whole time in her little carpet bag. She was a very tiny woman. She had been kicked by a mule as a child, so she had her jaw misshapen, and a veterinarian had to reset it. So it was odd, and she had trouble speaking, and she never talked much because I think it was really painful. But she was the person I modeled Frances Posel after, because I needed to have somebody over there who started going right after the Second World War. And there she was, probably one of the most fearless women in my whole family. And nobody would have known that if we hadn't gone over to the village.
Perhaps that you've inherited an element of that fearlessness, Andrew, in terms of your writing, which seems uncompromisingly pure. There's not a lot of compromise in your work. Is that fair? You don't make it, your work isn't difficult, but you don't make it easy. You don't want to make it easy for the reader. You want to bring them into your complicated, rich, tapestried world. Is that fair?
I mean, isn't that the way of it? I got more time behind me than ahead, and I just think about how complicated life is, even, you know, family and vocation and jobs and everything. I mean, I think that's really that's what language ought to do, and it's certainly what in my estimation, the written language ought to do. Not stultifyingly difficult, but it really ought to get at the depths of the possibility of what can be known and understood. So yes, that's what I try for.
What would you say to some aspiring writers, or perhaps some established writers, who say that we need to compromise, that it's hard being a book writer, especially a fiction writer?
Yeah.
To sell one's books, to get access, to do interviews like this, you need to simplify. and that we need to compromise and perhaps commercialize?
Well, I think there's no good end to purposeful obscurity. I don't go for that. I do think though that if it's there, if the answer is there, if you read it, it's there. So I don't believe in purposeful obscurity. That difficult is somehow better. I don't subscribe to that. But I think, you know, different styles are acceptable. I'm reading Percival Everett's The Trees right now, and wow, it is an amazing novel. I just love it. A completely different style, very, very clean and just straight ahead, almost, the market is difficult. I'm certainly not a best-selling writer. I have probably a small fan base who likes my books. And do I wish more?
Not so small. LitHub are big fans of your
sure.
work.
Oh, absolutely.
Limited readership, but you seem to represent the old world of, I wouldn't call it middle class or middle range writers, but you're not a bestseller. And at the same time, you're a quality writer. And that world seems to be disappearing in some ways in publishing.
Yeah. I'll tell you, I don't know how to answer that because I do think it's there. I reach for those writers. I hope it doesn't disappear. It's not going to disappear with me. I'm going to keep doing what I do. And actually, I really like being in this position because I do get to write what I want to write. I get to write.
Yeah, I can tell that. You choose. You noted, I saw an interview with you where you imagine your novel as a series of stories that can be dipped in and out of. And in that sense, I think Alexander Heyman comes to mind too.
Yeah.
Are all novels in a way, Andrew, a series of short stories strung along?
Yeah, that's interesting. Perhaps I think the question of the narrative line is fascinating. Like the appearance of horses, I started with just a chronological line, and it was complete, but it just wasn't very interesting to me. And I was thinking about the way in which my grandmother would tell stories. I think in that same interview, I mentioned that, you know, we would go up to the house with my mother, and she would sit down and pour some tea and tell us something that was on her mind. She's a woman who lived alone. And then the next day she'd come down for Sunday lunch and she'd tell us something connected to what she told us the day before. And then, you know, a month later at some holiday feast, she would pull it all together with this grand story about a larger event in the family. And I thought, wow, you know, isn't that the way that stories unfold? And it's not because she was, you know, old and losing her mind. It's because that's the way the story unfolded for her and the way it had to be told. So when I thought about that, I started to just move the chapters around. And so, for instance, the second chapter, plot spoiler here, you know that Beshet Connor has died. And it's not until the next chapter that he gets to World War I. So, you know, you're reading it knowing that he's going to come home from the war. But it just created a different type of revelation, if you will, of plot and appearances in a way that the novel takes from its title. So if that's the case, I do believe in the old Greek notion of the anagnorisis, the great revelation. So yeah, I think that's a fair point to think about novels as short stories moving along, narrative arcs within a larger narrative arc.
2023 is of course the year of, for better or worse, of ChatGPT, where AI is becoming real. We've done a number of shows, including with Stephen Marsh, the Canadian writer, who believes that ChatGPT will actually help creators. Certainly one of the good things about the ChatGPT story is that it's reminded everyone of our unique relationship with language. So a couple of final questions, Andrew. I'm curious as to your thoughts on ChatGPT. I'm guessing you're probably not particularly excited by it. But secondly, what do your books tell us about the uniqueness of language and of our invention as humans, the one thing that other species don't, at least to us, seem to be able to replicate?
Right. I'm not very excited about it. You're spot on. To me,
I'm curious why, because you think it's cheap?
Yeah, not at all. I'll tell you what. I think it's for me, it holds no interest because I don't think it understands beauty in the way that a good writer understands the beauty of language in any language. And if ChatGPT can get to that point, then I will rethink my entire sense of what AI can and can or cannot do. I mean, it's not that I'm against technology. I just think that there's a place for the way in which language is beautiful, and that it's our job as writers to bring that beauty to the world in a form, in a line, in a paragraph, in a chapter. I just, to me, that's one of the great acts of love that you could do is to show someone something beautiful in the world. And so that's what I'm trying to get at as a writer.
And actually, thinking out loud again, given the nature of our conversation and the nature of your work, Andrew, language is, and the way you use language is a way of bringing everything and everyone to life.
Yes, absolutely. I have a
pretty... It's beyond communication. It's not about just saying, well, I'd like this or that.
Exactly. And to go back to your comment about, writing just being more clear and less, less difficult, for lack of a better word, just less, exacting. I think there's an element of that in there too, is that the depth of the language has a purpose and a place and a substance that we really shouldn't just give up on. I don't want to. That's why I'm holding my line here. Again, not a Luddite, just a lover of language.
You mentioned earlier that you had been a Jesuit, or you'd studied
right.
Church in Slovakia. Is this in an odd way your stab at eternity, this love affair with language, to make Andrew Krivak, and I don't mean this in any critical way, but to bring not just your grandparents and all those generations back to life eternally, but also yourself?
Honestly, Andrew, I'll tell you that I had never thought about that, because I don't know that books will be around much. If you've read my novel, The Bear, you'll see why. But I don't think about it from that perspective. My theology is completely different from that. I believe that we don't think enough about just existence and being. Like, even though if my material body dissolves at death, somehow everything that's made me is still not gonna, there's no nothing, there's no not being. There's still material, and I'm okay with that. Just be part of this world. The stream of quantum mechanics, I suppose that's the case. But anyway, I don't really, I don't write to be eternal. I write because I love language, and I want to see if I could make something beautiful in the world.
Well, you certainly have done with the Appearance of Horses. It's already been embraced by the literary press. It was starred by Kirkus Review. Finally, Andrew, is this the end? Is this the final trilogy? Could there be a fourth book? You're going to bring all these characters back to life again?
No Darden trilogy. No, I'm sorry. No Darden novel. No, but I'm still working. It's what I do. Get up in the morning and hit the desk. So, yeah.